and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The Trump administration, along with Israel, clearly appear to be preparing for a showdown with Iran. Essentially, Tehran must surrender its sovereignty or face a massive military attack. Washington is demanding the impossible. Conflict seems inevitable. Crosstalking Iran, I'm joined by my guest, Giorgio Caffiero in Washington. He's CEO of Gulf State Analytics. In Dalmar, we have Scott Ritter. He is a former intelligence officer and United Nations weapons inspector. And in Istanbul, we have Sami Aliaran. He is director of the Center for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zam University. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Scott, let me go to you first in Dalmar. There's so many confusing signals coming out from the Trump administration. His National Security Council advisor making demands on Iran. When Trump was meeting with the Israeli prime minister, it was slightly different, but that's just kind of Trump, I guess. And then we have the Iranian foreign minister in the New York Times with a quite conciliatory letter, and I think it was addressed directly to Donald Trump. I saw you on an appearance you made on Judge Knapp recently. You're very pessimistic. Go ahead, Scott.
Well, I mean, a lot of the events that you've just described have occurred after my appearance on Judge Napolitano. I'm never a fan of the maximum pressure campaign. I think that is counterproductive. I'm not a fan of peace through strength because that's also an intimidation. And the Iranians have not shown themselves to be swayable through threats. I am a fan of negotiations. I'm a fan of reason. And for that reason, I think I'm increasingly optimistic about the potential for a negotiated settlement. I thought it was very telling that Donald Trump, sitting next to Benjamin Netanyahu, after Benjamin Netanyahu tried to twist Trump's arms into promoting a military campaign, said, no, I'm sending Steve Witkoff to Oman to carry out negotiations that the Iranians had previously said, we're not going to do. So here we are in a situation where both sides have talked extremely tough. And yet, on Saturday, the president's special envoy, who, by the way, is the man that broke the ice with Russia, is going to sit down with the Iranian foreign minister. I know it's they call it indirect talks, but and I am optimistic that there is a deal to be made. And I was even further encouraged when Witkoff said, hey, look, if I need to travel to Iran to meet with these people, I'm prepared to do that. This is unprecedented. This shows that the Trump administration is actually committed to finding a way out of this problem. Whether they'll be able to do this, I don't know. But yeah. What I'm seeing right now is that they have stepped away from the irresponsible bellicosity that had, you know, preceded this current phase of embracing.
Well, what makes it very curious, I agree with you down the line. Giorgio, if I can go to you in Washington, I mean, but it was Donald Trump that walked away from the JCPOA. Is he going to attempt a 2.0? That would be ironic at the very least, because in the Oval Office, with the Israeli prime minister sitting next to him, he said, Iran cannot have the bomb. All the other things that we'd heard weeks before wasn't even mentioned in that context, which I'm agreeing with Scott here. I mean, they want to address this issue and only this issue, as far as we know. Giorgio.
Yeah, thank you. Good to be on your show. You know, there is a lot that's really unclear. Been so much discussion, debate over whether or not there are going to be direct or indirect talks. I think what really matters in terms of the talks in Oman on Saturday is really the substance and really what the two sides would be willing to concede. You're absolutely right that Trump's saying that the real issue here is that Iran can't have a nuclear weapon. He's not mentioning the other issues, ballistic missiles, drones, the Islamic Republic's support for certain actors in the Arab world, such as Lebanon's Hezbollah, the Houthis in Yemen, so on and so forth. So we don't really know what the two sides are going to be willing to concede to the other. But getting to your point about the fact that it was Trump who sabotaged the JCPOA back in May 2018, this is really I think the biggest stumbling block is a total lack of trust between the two sides. And even if Trump and his team are willing to negotiate something like a JCPOA 2.0, there is literally nothing the Trump administration can do to guarantee to Tehran that the next administration, whether that's run by a Democrat or a Republican, won't do to a second nuclear deal what Trump did to the first one, unless this becomes a treaty. But maybe that's something to talk about later.
Well, that, I think that's probably the only way the Iranians would go along with it. Let's talk about the pressures on the Trump administration, Sammy. I mean, ever since October 7th, it's obvious that American administrations give Israel everything they want to commit a genocide, first and foremost, in Gaza. But up until the last few news cycles, it seems like it's categorized. The Trump administration doesn't care what Israel does in Palestine, Gaza, but it does care about other things. That's becoming more and more clear. Would you agree?
Certainly. I mean, this is a crisis that Trump himself created when he walked out of that agreement. And now he's trying to get back to it. But there's a huge difference between not having a bomb on one hand and dismantling completely the nuclear program that Iran has been working on now for decades. So if that's the intention, if that's, and that's, of course, what Netanyahu has been asking, and has been saying that it has to be something akin to what they did to Gaddafi in Libya, that's not going to happen. There's not going to be a deal where Iran's going simply to fold and give up all its nuclear technology. That's not going to happen. But if he is looking forward to get something like what Obama got, which is basically to make sure that Iran will not have a bomb, I think the Iranians are willing to deal with that and are willing to give the guarantees needed for this. And that's exactly what he could have gotten years ago, and now see if that's his intention or whether he is trying to basically say that I tried negotiations and now it's time to drop the bomb.
Well, it's Scott, one of these oddities is that, you know, the National Intelligence Report came out a few weeks ago and it says that Iran isn't trying to weaponize a bomb here. But then we have the president saying Iran can't have the bomb. I mean, what is he listening to his own people or not? I mean, because we've heard this for 30 years. We've heard for 30 years is that Iran's going to have the bomb in 20 minutes. Go ahead, Scott.
Well, first of all, the national threat assessment that Tulsi Gabbard briefed to the United States Senate was factually correct, that Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program. There's no evidence that a nuclear weapons program exists in Iran today. And furthermore, she said that the Iranian leadership continues to articulate that it does not want a nuclear weapons program. So those are both statements of fact. What Donald Trump is talking about is something completely different. And this is where I may get some people angry. Iran may not have a nuclear weapons program, but Iran has become a nuclear threshold state, meaning that within a matter of days, maybe weeks if you stretch it, Iran would be able to have the capacity of possessing 3 to 5 nuclear weapons.
You're saying breakout.
We're past breakout. Breakout is something complete. Breakout's what the JCPOA was designed to prevent. Iran has broken out, and that's the danger. When you have Iranian officials, senior Iranian officials, acknowledging that they are days away from having nuclear weapons, this means that Iran is a nuclear threshold state. And this changes the equation completely. I agree with Sammy. Look, we can't come in and tell the Iranians, you have to get rid of your entire program. That makes the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty a joke. Iran has Article 4 rights, and those rights are manifest. Iran has no right, and I'll say this again, no right whatsoever to be a nuclear threshold state.
Okay, explain to our audience why.
Well, because, first of all, Iran signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, a non-nuclear weapon state. And furthermore, just so people, because I hear a lot of pushback from people who say, look, the NPT doesn't even include the concept of a nuclear threshold state. And I say, with all due respect, the JCPOA did. The entire premise of the JCPOA was a one-year breakout window. That's it. And the world acknowledged, when I say the world, Russia, China, France, Europe, everybody said Iran cannot be a nuclear threshold state. That would be an existential threat to international peace and security worthy of a Chapter 7 resolution. I'm not making this up. That's what the world said. So here we have a situation where, again, I'm not blaming Iran. They've done everything by the book. But Iran has to understand that when you have a United States that's so closely linked to Israel, and I'm not saying this is good, I'm saying it's reality. And when the Israelis say Iran can't have a nuclear weapon or it threatens us, America says you cannot be a nuclear threshold state. And what Iran has done today with its accumulation of 60% enrichment and other capacity is waving the red flag in front of the American
people. Well, I mean, but what does it want in return? Giorgio, you jump in there because maximum pressure, all of these threats here. It's no surprise that Iran is doing this. Who would blame them? Go ahead.
Well, I think if Iran is going to one day, I really emphasize the word if, become a nuclear armed state, Iran's motivations for making that move would be the exact same as the motivations of the nine countries that do have nuclear weapons today. It's simply about security. If Iran were to develop 3 to 5 nuclear weapons, again, same reason why the United States has thousands of nuclear weapons, because they think it's in their security interests. I think it's not too difficult to understand why there are certain figures in Tehran who do advocate that Iran become a nuclear armed state in light of so many developments that took place last year in the region, with different actors and players in the axis of resistance being decapitated or severely weakened. Iran's sort of forward defense posture has been compromised severely. And I think the Iranians genuinely fear that the U.S. Israeli alliance represents a serious threat to Iran's national security. And it makes sense that there are some in Iran who think that the appropriate way to deal with that threat is to develop a nuclear weapon.
Well, Giorgio, before we go to the break here, well, Iran certainly has gotten Washington's attention, and maybe that's the strategy as well, okay, because Iran's security requirements have to be met. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a hard break, and after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on Iran. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing Iran. Okay, let's go back to Istanbul. Sammy, as it always is the case, we always hear what the West wants, what Trump wants, what Israel wants. But what do the Iranians want in all of this here? As it's already been pointed out on this program, high-level talks, direct or indirect, are going on soon. What is Iran going to say to directly or indirectly to the Americans?
Well, first of all, the only reason Iran is a nuclear threshold state is because of Trump. He's the one who walked out of this. Would have guaranteed that they would never reach that goal. Now, since he's withdrawn, he can't blame but himself. But now, talking about what Iran wants is to make sure that it's a system of government, that it is it's a state will survive. Iran has been under tremendous pressure since the revolution, not only through the different intimidation tactics that the U.S. and the West, generally speaking, have been using, but also don't forget the 8-year war that was initiated by Saddam Hussein, in which they lost hundreds of thousands of people, and they learned the lesson: unless they are strong, they will be attacked again and again. And let's not forget that Israel is a nuclear state, and it has threatened Iran. We're not talking about that this is a free nuclear region. Israel is a nuclear power, and therefore you need to have enough deterrence so that Israel would never even think about using this bomb, even though some of its cabinet ministers have been threatening to use it against Gazans, let alone Iranians. So what Iran wants is to stay in the region as a credible, powerful state that it can secure its interests. It has said again and again that they're not interested in building a nuclear power, a nuclear arsenal. They have a fatwa from the religious leader in which it is prohibited for them to have a nuclear power. But that doesn't mean that this could also be the case if the West or Israel continue to threaten them, not only with ending their technological advancement, whether in nuclear or other places, but also as a power in the region. You know, there has been many attempts by the West since at least the mid-90s, and I'm sure Scott knows this, that they have been trying to destabilize the regime. They have funded hundreds of millions of dollars in trying to stoke any kind of, you know, these minorities around. They have 18 different ethnic minorities. So they have been under tremendous pressure. They have killed their scientists. They have tried to derail their programs in many scientific advancements and so on and so forth. So Iran cannot just give up. Iran wants to make sure that can be respected as a regional power and that it can stay within the realm of an international system by which it cannot be dealt with as being always an outcast by being threatened by the West.
That's why it's so interested in BRICS. Scott, one of the things I find worrisome in this environment, particularly since October 7th, is that there are people in Netanyahu's government that want to solve all problems everywhere all at once. And that is the pressure that is on Donald Trump. Because committing the genocide in Gaza certainly has disrupted Hamas. Hezbollah has been deflated. We have regime change in Syria. They're telling Trump, let's finish the job. Go ahead, Scott.
Absolutely. But, you know, this isn't unique to Trump, the gentlemen who are on the show with me know full well. The United States has had a policy of regime change against Iran since 1979.
Yep.
And it's never changed until recently. Even when Barack Obama signed the JC or didn't, you know, entered into the JCPOA, understand at the same time his CIA had a Iran mission center whose singular focus was regime change. In 2023, September, I met with President Raisi in New York, and he articulated the threat that was posed by this regime change entity, conglomerate. As Sami mentioned, there are different ethnic groups that foreign hostile powers are trying to use to bring down Iran. In the summer of 2023, there was a major period of unrest that was funded and promoted by foreign intelligence. And President Raisi said it was the greatest threat to the security of Iran since the Iran-Iraq war. And that was CIA sponsored. That was Mossad sponsored, MI6 sponsored, other intelligence services sponsored this. So it's not as though, you know, Trump invented this. What Trump has done for the first time in since the Islamic Republic came in, is said, I am not interested in regime change. I am interested in bringing this nuclear program under control so that Iran can't have a nuclear bomb, but then getting Iran on track with the lifting of sanctions. So we have a president who, at least rhetorically speaking, has changed. I'd like to know more about Tulsi Gabbard and what she, as the director of national intelligence, is doing in terms of redirecting the CIA. Will the CIA cease and desist this decades-long program of seeking regime change and you know, go into a more productive thing, such as monitoring Iranian compliance, which is a legitimate function of intelligence? There are many unanswered questions here, but for the first time, and this is again why I have a degree of optimism, for the first time we have an American president who is saying something other than the regime must go.
You know, Giorgio, one of the problems the Americans have in diplomacy, if they even have any diplomacy more, they can't take the answer yes. That is going to be a problem here. I can see how Trump could take this as a win. Others, even within his own party, will not. Compromise is a difficult thing for American foreign policy. Giorgio.
Yeah, you know, speaking of reasons for optimism, we can go on and on about all the stumbling blocks to a second nuclear deal and why it's going to be very challenging for Washington and Tehran to get there. But again, about being optimistic, I do actually think that if it is Trump in the White House when the US and Iran negotiate some sort of a nuclear accord, that could actually be very positive in the sense that with Trump at the helm, we might see Republicans get on board. I think had Kamala Harris won or had Joe Biden had another term, there would
Let me ask you, what about the lobby? I mean, this is an obvious factor in all of this here. How is Trump going to react to that, to their pressure?
Well, that's also another reason why it's difficult to imagine the two sides negotiating and making a compromise. There's no doubt that the Trump administration is aligning U.S. foreign policy extremely closely with Netanyahu's foreign policy, and the Israel lobby is going to do everything it can to try to undermine diplomacy with Iran. But let's also keep in mind that the Israel lobby, as powerful as it is, does not always get everything its way. The fact that the U.S. entered the JCPOA in 2015 underscored that point. What's also interesting to note, and this is one of my takeaways from the Trump-Netanyahu meeting in the Oval Office, is that when it comes to the Gaza genocide, I definitely think the two leaders are totally on the same page. But on some other issues, including diplomacy with Iran, there seems to be some daylight between Trump and Netanyahu. Also, when it comes to the question of Turkey's role in post-Assad Syria, Trump and Netanyahu are definitely not on the same page. So it is interesting, at least rhetorically, to see Trump making it clear to Netanyahu that your country has its own interests. That's all well and good, but Israel will not necessarily dictate U.S. foreign policy. Also, I do want to caveat this by saying Trump is always all over the map, and rhetoric that comes from him on Monday is not always consistent with what actually happens on Tuesday. But the fact that we have this rhetoric from Trump is something that we should not dismiss as insignificant.
I agree. Sammy, I'm glad that Giorgio brought up the whole issue of Turkey and Syria and the way Trump reacted to it. I was really quite surprised by that. But I guess maybe to address this to all three of you first, Sammy here, are we just have to get used to a madman foreign policy in the White House for the next 4 years? Sammy?
Who knows?
I mean, who knows?
He's surprising everybody with his pronouncement. But I wasn't surprised about Turkey, because even John Bolton has said it in his memoir, as well as in his many interviews, that there is a special relationship, he thinks, between Erdogan and Trump. And I think that came out of Buenos Aires in 2018, when Trump appealed to Erdogan to save his buddy, Mohammed bin Salman. And I think since then he's been very grateful because of that relationship. But going back to Iran, there are four issues on the table here. You know, it's not just the nuclear issue, but there are, you know, the Americans would like also to talk about the proxy non-state actors that Iran support, which is part of its foreign policy, and that's not going to change. And also its missile program, they're not going to give that up. So the Americans would have to basically be contend with the issue of the nuclear, that Iran should not be a nuclear arsenal state, and they would be willing to do that. But also the other issue is the relief of the sanctions. There is lack of trust here between the two actors, and they need to come up with a formula by which Iran would guarantee that it will never be a nuclear power state. At the same time, the Americans would have to guarantee that these very, very strong sanctions that have been imposed in Iran would be lifted. Otherwise, there is no incentive for Iran to give up that kind of leverage.
Scott, is it doable, what we just heard from Sammy?
I think so. I think we have to be realistic here. The waters are too muddy. And there is no trust. I think the best we're going to get out of this deal is to stop a war. And for that, Iran will have to negotiate away aspects of its nuclear program. If Iran is expecting the lifting of sanctions, the normalization of relations, I think that's unrealistic. I don't think Donald Trump can lift sanctions because of Iran's missile program, its relationship with the Houthi, Hezbollah, et cetera. I think that what Steve Witkoff will probably do is negotiate conflict termination based upon verifiable things, and then say everything else will wait till later. And then it's up to Iran to engage with BRICS. Iran has to stop dilly-dallying. The Iranian president has to recognize that this future is not with the West, but with the East. And once Iran commits to that, the economic issues will take care of themselves.
Okay, well, I think, Scott, everybody was nodding your head when you said the win would be avoiding the war, and I think that is the way we should end this program here. I want to thank my guests in Washington, Del Mar, and in Istanbul, and of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.